you're listening on our public feed, which includes a shortened version of this episode. To hear the extended version and get access to our bonus shows, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network, the home of great music podcasts. Visit us at fmpods.com.
You are listening to the Dilettantes Podcast.
Hey everyone, I'm Jim Salvucci of the Dilettantes, and welcome to the latest installment of Million Dollar Bash.
It's that Million Dollar Bash.
We are entering a season of maximum hype for the Timothée Chalamet vehicle, James Mangold's biopic of Bob Dylan, A Complete Unknown. The release date is December 25th, 2024, and I, for one, can wait. It's not that I don't dearly love movies about Bob Dylan. It's just that I don't trust this particular director to create anything but a feel-good yawner complete with loving recreations of settings and a superficial interest in actual biographical details. But that's me. Besides, haven't we already traversed the Dylan biopic territory with I'm Not There? Granted, even diehard Dylan fans have found it hard to digest, but isn't that how it should be? In my case, I think I'm Not There is about as suitable and excellent a crack at Dylan's biopic that we shall ever see. The eminent filmmaker, Todd Haynes, is known for such masterpieces as Far From Heaven, The Velvet Goldmine, Carol, and last year's May December. His first movie, the highly acclaimed and now legally banned Superstar, The Karen Carpenter Story, is told using Barbie dolls, so you know that Haynes is not a conventional filmmaker in any way. Indeed, his 2007 film, I'm Not There, is anything but your grandpa's biopic. For one thing, absolutely no one in the film is named Bob Dylan, the feature's ostensible subject. In fact, no one utters the words Bob Dylan, and many of the events depicted have, at most, a tangential relationship to the life and times of said Bob Dylan. On the other hand, Dylan's music features prominently and wonderfully throughout, and some settings, dialogue, and events are Dylan lyrics put to film. If you are not aware or need a reminder, in the film, six actors portray six characters who correspond somewhat to aspects of Dylan's life and personality, although some scenes fall clearly into the subgenre of what if. What if Bob Dylan found Jesus as a young man and became a Pentecostal minister? What if Bob Dylan were an actor portraying a Bob Dylan-like character in a biopic? The characters that stand in for Dylan are an 11-year-old black hobo, a nearly hermit-like aging cowboy, a hotshot actor with a passion for cheating on his artist wife, a folk singer turned small-time devout preacher, a poet who's being interrogated for some reason, and a hipster rock star immersed in a world of amphetamine and androgyny. Meanwhile, several other characters in the movie are Dylan adjacent, an Albert Grossman-like manager, a Joan Baez-like folk singer, brilliantly portrayed by perennial Haynes actor Julianne Moore, a Bobby Newhart-type sidekick, and, for some reason, Bobby Seale, Huey P. Newton, and Allen Ginsberg. That last one is wonderfully portrayed by David Cross. And for good measure, this non-biopic shows us the actor character Robbie Clark in a scene from his biopic of Jack Rollins. For those at home keeping score, that's a fictional biopic of a fictional character within a non-biopic of a real person. Still with me? As biography, I'm Not There, it falls way short, but it never fully attempts biography. Indeed, like Dylan's unreliable memoir, Chronicles Volume 1, and Scorsese's Rolling Thunder review of Bob Dylan's story, it is a metabiography that uncovers the constructedness of Bob Dylan in our culture. Furthermore, as a non-biopic or even a metabiopic, it explores the fraught limitations and possibilities of biography itself, particularly when it is contained entirely within the four corners of a screen. I hope that cues it up pretty well and cues up our discussion of Todd Haynes' 2007 film, I'm Not There. So let's meet our Million Dollar Bashers today. Say hello, Court Carney.
Hello, everyone.
Braley Heron.
Hey there. Glad to be here.
Ern Callahan.
Hey, everyone. Glad to be here again.
And Nina Goss.
Hello. Nice to see everyone.
Great to have everyone here. And unfortunately, Rock and Rob won't be able to make it, but I'm sure he's with us in spirit because I know this is a subject he really loves. So let's get your hot takes or cold takes or old takes or new takes on I'm Not There.
I think your intro was an impossible act to follow. So I'm just going to sign off because I agree with everything you said.
Okay. So, Nina and I are in agreement.
Yes. I love this movie. I love it. And it's exhilarating and creative and does injustice to Dylan. Question I want to raise here is whether, in fact, Michael Gray and other critics are right that despite all its wonders for people like us, or me and Jim, how accessible and the film really is to people who don't know a thing about Bob Dylan.
I can answer. I used to teach I'm Not There in my Lit and Film class with Chronicles and also the Scorsese film. And the students, when they got to I'm Not There, said that they wouldn't have gotten it if they hadn't read
they
Chronicles.
Wouldn't have.
Or seen the Scorsese film. And it allowed them some sort of access to at least the narrative arcs that are in the film outside of discussing the film because they hadn't seen all the photos, like the Arthur Rimbaud interview where it's mimicking Dylan photos and stuff
But
at least the narratives they could follow because we had gone over Chronicles and the Scorsese documentary. So I would assume that's probably the case for most casual
people. That otherwise the pastiche would have been inaccessible. They wouldn't sit right. Yeah.
I used to have a similar experience using this film, and I was using it in a Dylan course. And even then, the students were like, there's a lot of this. It's just over my head. And there is. There's tons. I guess the question, another way of looking at that question, though, is this, does this film stand alone in its own right without knowing a great deal of background about Bob Dylan?
I want so badly for it. Well, after I saw the day it came out, and I got to say, here in New York, the lines were around the block to get into this film. And I don't think that will be the same case for Mr. Chalamet and his impersonation. But when it was over, all I wanted was for this film to be the new Citizen Kane. I wanted this to be an American Life, just outlined and charged with the sense of what an American life is. But I don't think that's its profile or status. I don't think it can be. I don't think it's accessible enough to do that.
For the record, Nina, I was in that theater with you. We didn't know each other then and went for quite a few years.
At the film forum?
Yeah, I was there.
The film forum? Do you remember that line around there?
I was in it.
Hello. That's right.
I came up from Baltimore to see that movie.
Yep. Oh, that's so cool.
What are other thoughts?
It's a Bob Dylan. It's a great movie made by a hardcore Dylan fan for hardcore Dylan fans. And we're going to talk about all its many brilliances over the course of the next hour. But I, for one, I think there's room for a conventional biopic like I'm anticipating the Timothée Chalamet vehicle to be, and room for this. I think that probably it'll be a more spoon-fed, straightforward, conventional film that we're going to see that's going to play up the love interests and that sort of thing. And okay, I'll see it. And I think that the more casual fan will understand that film, get it more readily than I'm Not There. But I sure am glad that there's an I'm Not There out there too. And I'll tell you, the connection point that immediately comes to me just because I saw it literally this week was the film about Samuel Beckett, Dance First. I was one of only four people in the theater, so it quickly closed. That is not a popular subject, but it was in a lot of ways a pretty conventional biopic. And the Beckett purist in me, I wish Rob were here too, because I know he's a huge Beckett guy as well, but the Beckett purist in me wanted it to be more about the work and for the film to, in certain ways, grapple with the kind of aesthetic innovations that one associates with Beckett's work. But I guess if I want that, I can just go see a Beckett play. I'm not going to get it out of the Gabriel Byrne vehicle. And yet it was fascinating at times to feel like you're a fly on the wall with young Beckett having conversations with Joyce and his family in Paris. And yeah, I suspect that what I saw in that Beckett biopic is going to be pretty similar to what we'll see with the Timothée Chalamet. What's it called? Complete Unknown. That's fine. It'll probably sell a lot more tickets across the nation than I'm Not There. but I bet I'll be returning more often to I'm Not There than I will to A Complete Unknown.
I know we need to get to I'm Not There, but my only comment, which it seems a little different on this, is that I was fairly ambivalent about the film until I read that interview that Mangold gave where he's talking about why he was attracted to it. And he's talking about the fact that the film is about a guy who's in Minnesota and then is choking to death. The phrase he uses is choking to death. And so he runs away and he reinvents himself and he creates this new life in New York and he creates all this new sort of thing. And then he finds himself choking to death. So he runs away again. And that concept of this young kind of creative person constantly feeling trapped and enmeshed and then reinventing and then feeling trapped by that and then reinventing, I found that really moving. And I think that part of it, maybe if the film is within that realm of it, it could be interesting. Ultimately, I don't care about biopics. Ultimately, I want it to be a good film. I want it to be a creative film. I want it to be successful. I want it to be great. And it could be. It very well could be. But I don't need it to be like, here's the story of Bob. That's not interesting to me. I want it to be a good film. And I'm Not There is a story of Dylan, but it's also much bigger than that. I think it really is a beautiful film. And I think it's a film that kind of gets into the brain a bit, which I think the best films do.
And I don't want to be unfair. I'm making all these assumptions and casting aspersions about a film that I've not even seen yet. And I'm very, like you, Cord, very hopeful. I want it to be a good film. I'm really just going on the trailer. And on the trailer, I think Chalamet's done his homework, right? He's trying to get down the look. He's trying to get down the voice. He's not Bob Dylan. Who is? But you can see he's trying. And yet, where my criticism is coming from is that when I went back to watch I'm Not There again, the scenes and the performances that I was least impressed by were the ones that were most imitative, right? The Christian Bale, who clearly did his homework to try and look and sound and mumble like Bob Dylan, and it just fell flat to me. The best moments in I'm Not There are not the ones that are trying to be this kind of photographic accuracy, verisimilitude in imitating Bob Dylan. No, it's when, like in Jem's introduction, where you're taking all these various influences and you're throwing them together like ingredients in a blender and making this smoothie of something that you can see is related to Bob Dylan, but is so different than Bob Dylan. That's when the I'm Not There excels. It's when it's not trying to imitate Bob Dylan. And if I have some skepticism about The Complete Unknown, it's from that trailer, which makes me think that they're leaning into the, let's see who can do the most convincing Bob Dylan imitation.
I would push back a little on the Christian Bale thing. I think that he's deliberately miscast in a way that he's productively miscast in his height and his age and the angularity of his face, everything. It's a parody, the TV thing, when he's all shucks, and it's an excessive parody of the character. And the gospel section is just hilariously mortifying to see him. He's got the fro and the eyeliner, and it seems extreme and hilarious to me. So I totally see what you're saying, that there's a way that that's trying to do Bob, but I think that Haynes knows what he's doing and is pushing this into a kind of parody of grotesquerie that works with the whole movie. But I see what you're saying.
I think, okay, so I agree with everything you've said about Complete Unknown, but I think I'm a little bit more positive because I do think that it will bring new folks to Bob Dylan. And if this is their banal entry point, hopefully it will get them to something deeper once they dig into Dylan and his art and whatnot. So for that reason, I'm excited about the show, because I think, not because there'll be great performances, because I think you're right, it's going to be this mainstream biopic of Dylan starring someone who Gen Z is really excited about, and hopefully they'll see that and then go back to the source material and find something deeper and richer in it. And that's my hope for the film.
Yeah, I see. I hope that will happen too. I hope that was going to happen with No Direction Home, but the problem was that for neophytes, that was so excessive. That was so overstimulating that by the time it was over, they weren't rushing out to download Blonde on Blonde. They'd already had enough. Hopefully,
maybe this won't be overstimulating.
Exactly. Yeah.
It'll be as milquetoast as they can handle.
Yeah.
Well, I have a feeling we're going to be talking a lot about that movie. Let's talk about I'm Not There. And I'm going to follow up on something Nina said about the preacher scene, the Jack Rollins preacher scene with Christian Bale. One of the things I love about that scene when he's preaching and then he starts singing, Pressing On, and actually a pretty wonderful cover of Pressing On too. And he does an impressive job of lip syncing, much better than Bob Dylan ever does. But one of the things I love about that is just the banality of the setting.
There's 12 people in the room.
It's this crappy room on a stage, and there's kids in the back of the room, and they start running around and playing, and the camera pans over to them and shows them playing while all this is going on, and it just undercuts everything that's happening in the scene. I think that's absolutely brilliant. It's one of the things, I watched this movie last night for the umpteenth time, and one of the things I love about it is its attention to unbelievable detail.
Yeah. Oh my God. The production design is amazing.
The shoes he's wearing in this.
That's the.
Yeah.
Just an office. His little cramped, shabby office that, you know, oh my God, he spent all day. But it's true. The production design is amazing. Michael Gray, in his review of it, talks about what a master of color Haynes is, and that, my God, the family, the white Bleeding Heart family that rescues Marcus, just that brief scene in the living room of their house, so they get the call from what's supposed to be Red Wing or whatever, the juvenile, and just every single item and the tone, the way he washes out the tone into this early 60s upscale white living. Oh, it's just so well done. Every scene, there's not an item or a tone out of place.
I think that's where it works its best. I think as a tone poem, as a, I was thinking this last time I watched it, I was just so drawn to Heath Ledger and Charlotte Gainsborough and the way that's filmed too. It looks 1970. It looks like that. And just the browns and the blues, and it's the way it's shot. But I think that's also, it reminds me of the other high level filmmaker of like Wes Anderson with Grand Budapest Hotel, where he's able, each time period's filmed with the technology of that time period. So it's subtle, but then you realize you're looking at a Soviet hotel. And this is the same kind of thing. All the different film references. If you're a film person, you're like, oh, this is where he's borrowing this from, all to create this Bob Dylan character. But there, that's why it's so multi-layered on this creative level, that it just is eminently, repeatedly valuable. And so you might start with Kate Blanchett because her performance is so amazing, but then it's like the whole divorce paper scene, and he's comparing that to Vietnam, and that there's a lot of really tricky pieces there that work, that really work. And I don't think you can, it's as tear jerky as it is, when you get Dylan at the end, it's a fucking.
Yeah. Oh my God. That is.
That's the performance.
What a brilliant choice that was.
It could have been so many things. It could have been.
It could have been so many things.
And this is where it's interesting. Are these Easter eggs? I don't think they are. They're almost like footnotes. They're like, look, I know this story. And if I'm going to be able to put these things in here so that you know that I know this story, and as a matter of trust, maybe, I don't know. But like to go to that harmonica performance, that's it. And I think if you had seen that and it didn't have the different tones, or if it had this, and it was like, that's whatever. And I also don't think it's in the service of saying, hey, did you catch this? I don't think it's about that at all. I think it's saying that this is a story that's very thoughtfully put together in a way that you're not going to be thinking, that's bullshit. Because he's also playing completely with all the characters. None of the characters are involved. So then, to trust that part of it, you have to know this other part. And for the oxygen of the film to make sense on that level, then you go away, then you go along with the other thing. I think that's one way of looking.
And the best parts are always when Bob Dylan is singing a song. Of course, in that case, it's just the harmonica. It's not even any, it's nonverbal. And yet it's also the most powerful moment in the entire film. But it reminds, it even runs the thread of undermining the film in that Bob Dylan steals the scene in every scene that he's in musically. And it runs the risk of you thinking, why am I not just watching and listening to Bob Dylan instead of a pale imitation of Dylan? But I agree.
It always makes me think that he's playing in a wonderful way on Yellow Submarine. You remember that tune? Yeah. And then at the very end, you see the Beatles.
Oh, really?
And then I feel that he's playing.
Interesting. Right.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for here in the public feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode and get access to extended and bonus episodes from this and all of the other shows on the network, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
Thank you for listening to the Dylan Tons Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to have the Dylan Tons sent directly to your inbox. And share the Dylan Tons on social media.